Welcome to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. The Education Subcommittee is 3 p.m. in Hearing Room F, Thursday, March 8, 2007. Good afternoon. Thursday, March 8, 2007. Yeah. Apologize, we're starting 45 minutes late, so we'll do what we can. We have a public hearing today on House Bill 5044, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I see we have on the agenda Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff from the Governor's Office, Marty Lowe, Policy Advisor from the Governor's Office, Dennis Johnson, and, Cap Sharples? Okay. And Vicki Merkel as well. So I think we're going to start with Mr. Nesbitt and Michelle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll make some introductory remarks. Unfortunately, I have to be upstairs at 4 o'clock, so I won't be able to stay here for the entirety of the testimony. I think some of you have heard this presentation from me before, but I'll recap. And let me start first. I'm Tim Nesbitt, former member of the State Board of Higher Education and continuing co-chair of the Board's Access and Affordability Work Group, and now also Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor. 3 years is a long time to be staring at a report card with a grade of F, which is what we've been seeing from these reports called Measuring Up when it comes to our standing in regard to access and affordability. And not just in regard to other states, there are 42 other states which also show an F in regard to access. So it's a national problem, but one that's more severe in Oregon. And it's no consolation to hear, as the most recent Measuring Up report stated, that for most of the 1990s, the United States ranked last among 14 nations in raising college participation rates, with almost no increase at all in the time since then. So it's a national problem, and we're one of 16 states now where the proportion of younger adults with an associate's degree or higher has fallen below that of older adults. So the generation following us is less likely to have a college degree than ours in Oregon. And that's a particular problem. You'll see it displayed more graphically in the slides that Margie Lau will show you. As I said, we've been paying attention to this problem for 3 years. 2 years ago, we made major steps forward when you increased funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, which is the key to affordability since it's our financial aid, our state-based financial aid program, by 77%. And the question we got then, and it was a constructive question as well as a challenging one, was when will we be done? When will these increases be enough to enable us to say we do have an affordable higher education system again in Oregon? And we took that challenge seriously. We went back and worked on deconstructing all the elements of affordability and then reconstructing a model for you that's not based on guesswork but based on a lot of hard data and research, beginning with the idea that when we conduct discussions with voters, we've had many focus groups, and we talk about college affordability and the governor's original proposal some years ago for an endowment plan, the voters were a little skeptical until they saw the corresponding contribution and effort from the students. An endowment program can sound too much like a gift that hasn't been earned. And, you know, one thing we take for granted in this country, but it's very critical to help people understand our education system and the transition from high school to college, is that if you're failing in K-12, if a student is failing in K-12, it's our fault. We're the adults. We should do something about it. But if a student is failing or failing to go on to college, very often we view it as their fault. They weren't motivated enough. They didn't work hard enough. And so that student effort component is very critical to winning people to our side when it comes to presenting a model for affordability and access to higher education. What gets voters' attention is the finding, the statement that, you know, it's no longer possible to work your way through college any longer. If you look back in the early 1970s, a student can work during the summer and work maybe 10 or 12 hours a week during the school year and pay his or her way through the University of Oregon. Not just tuition fees, but room and board, the full year's expenses. Nowadays, you'd have to work close to 50 hours a week, 52 weeks of the year to do that, which means you wouldn't have enough time to study and complete your studies. And that really is typical of a lot of the problems we're seeing now. Students are not only paying more, they're working longer, they're borrowing more, and all of those are deterrents both to entering college and to completing college on a timetable where a four-year degree is a four-year degree instead of what it is now, taking 6 years to completion. So we went back and looked at this idea of starting with student effort, the student contribution. What would be a reasonable amount of financial contribution to expect from every student, no matter what his or her circumstances, even a student with no family savings or resources? And it's that idea of being able to work during the summer, 10 or 12 hours a week during the school year, what would that be? You'll see the model assumes a certain dollar amount, but that would represent the minimum expectation for each student. If a student comes from a family with some resources, we'd expect that family to contribute, just as the feds do under the Pell Grant model, some portion of income and assets from the family. If the student is independent of a family, then we look at the resources of the household. And if there are none, you skip that step and go right to the Pell Grant. The Pell Grant, for the first time in many years, has been increased this year. And if it's increased in future years, all that will factor in before we get to the fourth and final step, which is the state's contribution, matching the efforts of student and family or student and household to make college education truly affordable again. So we're able to say to you with this model that we're not bringing you a proposal to make college more affordable or less unaffordable, but truly affordable. We go all the way there to a calculation that assures us this is a model with which we can look at every graduating high school student and say, if you have interest and ability, we can make this work for you. You can work during the summer if you have no other recourse or no other resources. Your family can kick in. You can count on your Pell Grant, and we'll make up the difference. Grants now have been averaging in the range of about $1,500 a year. Under this model, some will be as small as $200 or $300 for a student who may come from a family with income of $55,000 to $60,000 a year, but for the poorest students, those grants will increase to as high as $5,000. So we'll be covering a gap proportionately and matching the efforts of students and their families to make college affordable again. That's the concept we think is very compelling. When we presented this to the Business Council last summer, Jim Craven told us that he thought it was the best new big idea for the smallest price tag that he's heard in many years. Onto the price tag. You'll see a lot of modeling we've done to give you a proposal that's affordable under the governor's budget for $110 million in the next biennium, starting in the second year of the next biennium. There's ramp-up time and start-up time in order to get this underway. And we fully expect that cost will increase in later biennium because we're basing our estimates on a reasonable expectation of how many students will show up and take advantage of the program. We want that number to climb in future years, and so we do have to budget for roll-up costs here. I mean, that's something which I'm sure you'll be looking at. But it's a commitment I think we should make. It's one which in this budget, under this proposal, we can say we'll make good on the promise of affordability for higher education again, be able to tell our students right now who are sophomores and juniors in high school, by the time you graduate, we'll have a higher education system that's truly affordable. So we're hoping that we can gain your support for this. We've been talking to many of you for several years about this. This is the time where we can make it happen and make the shared responsibility model for the Oregon Opportunity Grant operational in full for the juniors in this year's high school class. By the time they graduate in June of 08, they'll be looking at a program that offers them a truly affordable path to our community colleges and our universities, both public and private. So with that, if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them, but you'll get a lot more detail in the presentation that follows from Marjorie Rapp.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Mr. Nesbitt, I just want to thank you for bringing this through the process. My first exposure to this was in the interim between the 03 and the 05 sessions when Senator Schrader and I worked with the Higher Ed Commission and the community college folks in a work group through that interim. And one of the issues we talked a lot about was how frustrating it was not to have any kind of an idea from a quantitative perspective about what was a reasonable expectation from a student and a family, what was a reasonable expectation from the scholarship aspect, and what was the gap. And so having finally gotten this model, I think really moves the ball down the court here a long way, where we can now have a discussion around some kind of an accounting-based framework. And I just want to salute your perseverance and the great work that you've done on the Higher Ed Commission, not just in this area, but in a number of different areas that have really helped streamline the way that we deliver education services in the 11th and 12th grade in the community college arena and the four-year arena. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions or comments?
Margie? Mm-hmm. And I apologize for having to leave first.
Yeah,
I'll be on call if something comes up.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm a policy advisor in the Office of the Governor. I think Tim covered some of the early slides here, and in the interest of time, I think we'll just flip through these pretty quickly. Tim already spoke to the challenges that we have in making sure that we have students motivated and knowing that post-secondary education is something that is really an option for their future. Unfortunately, the statistics right now show that a lot of our students aren't pursuing enough education. This shows that, you know, we don't have enough students finishing high school and then beyond that finishing a degree in post-secondary education. This is a loss to them, but it's also a loss to all of us. These are some statistics to speak to what the cost of education has done. You're all too aware of what that's had to be as the state's gone through some very tough economic times. And because of that, in combination with some of the federal policies, students' options have been more and more narrowed. And as Tim testified to the Senate Education Committee on the bill, you know, we've had to go to Plan B. And unfortunately, Plan B oftentimes has been borrowing. And you've heard from some of the students about how much borrowing they're doing, which is also really foreclosing a lot of opportunities for them after graduation. The current opportunity grant, even with the added funding that you helped provide for last in this current biennium, we didn't change how the model worked. We maintained it at the 11% of cost of attendance. As a reminder, cost of attendance includes tuition and fees, books, supplies, and reasonable living costs, which include transportation, room and board, that sort of thing. But 11% is a very small fraction of the total cost. And as costs have risen, we've stayed at the 11%, which we often heard from students meant they just couldn't continue going. Because of that, we see more and more students attending college part-time, which lengthens the time to degree, if they manage to persist. Unfortunately, the statistics show that as a student shifts to part-time, their likelihood of finishing a degree drops considerably. This is an illustration that was done for the Access and Affordability Group that illustrates how financial aid works in Oregon presently. The lower section here in yellow is the federal Pell Grant, with families being eligible up to the mid-40,000s. The state Opportunity Grant, families are eligible up to about the 30,000 range. And the state grant has been a flat grant. Again, 11% of cost of attendance for whatever school the student chose to attend. And then beyond that, the expectation was that the contribution would come from the family or from other resources, which unfortunately meant student work or borrowing. The Access and Affordability Work Group has met very earnestly for a considerable period of time and worked during this last interim with a pair of consultants from the Western Interstate Compact on Higher Education to help build a model that had these principles as the focal point of how we wanted to proceed. Issues of fairness, equity, respecting the student choice to attend the institution of their that they felt best fit their educational needs. Was it efficient? Is it predictable? Is it stable? And is it understandable? So with that, we moved into a model that Tim spoke to in terms of the four steps to covering that, starting with the student share and then adding in the other pieces, and I'll cover those in more detail here. I wanted to cover in terms of how we, what we've assumed for cost of attendance under the shared responsibility model. Presently under the opportunity grant, the Student Assistance Commission uses an unweighted average of the cost of attendance for each of the sectors if they're the public sector. So community colleges, they average together the cost of attendance for all 17. They do likewise for the 7 Oregon University System schools. And then for the independent schools, it's 11% of the cost of attendance for each school. Under the new model, we treat all of the four-year schools the same, and their cost of attendance would be projected at the unweighted average of the 7 Oregon University System schools. It also adds in what's expected to be reasonable budgets for books and supplies and modest living expenses. The work group spent a fair amount of time discussing how to decide living expenses and settled on the fairest approach being to assume that students lived off campus but not at home. So then we move to the first step here, which is the student share under the model. That includes several components, depending upon what the resources are that the student has. It could be their personal savings from gifts that they've gotten from relatives over the years, or their earnings during the summertime, or a paper route, or whatever they've had in the past. Also a reasonable work effort. The pricing that you will see is predicated on the assumption that a full-time student would be able to work an average of 15 hours a week, 48 weeks a year. That can be broken out in a number of different ways where a student could choose to work full-time during the summertime and fewer hours during the academic year, again, depending upon what their own circumstances allow. Work-study obviously comes into this piece as well. They can also take out loans. For our assumptions around the community colleges, we've done the modeling so that students would not have to take out loans, but their obligation would be covered only from their work effort. Or for students in the four-year institutions, the assumption is that borrowing would be $2,750 per year. That adds up to about $13,000 in total borrowing over a four-year degree, with the expectation that that was a reasonable debt burden if a student was choosing to go into a career like education or social work, one of our not highly paid public sector careers. Our students could also earn scholarships. We did not want to put anything in this model that would create a disincentive towards philanthropy or for students being recognized for various things that they've done in terms of community service or other meritorious activities. So we moved the grant from being a flat amount based on the 11% cost of attendance to instead one that's based on need. So the lowest income students will receive the largest grant, and that would be a combination between state resources and the federal Pell. If you look at the model, sometimes when we get into some of the upper income ranges, those students have lost Pell eligibility but still have a tremendous amount of need. And so the state grant actually is larger when looked at by itself than that combination of Pell and state resources for the lowest income families. And then it phases out as students have less need and more family resources to rely on. It also raises the maximum income limits for families. Under the model, it's about $60,000 where eligibility phases out for family income. For a family of four with one dependent student in college. Presently, that's about $31,000. For an independent student without dependents, it phases out at $35,000. Presently, it's just a little bit more than $9,000. And for an independent student with dependents, including kids, the current cutoff is $30,000, but would raise that to about $60,000. And I'll show you some illustrations of how that plays through. Again, our commitment was to close the affordability gap, not to narrow it, but to actually close it, and to eliminate the cliff instead with a slope. So I think I've covered most of the points here, so I'm going to move ahead. Again, here's what is, and here's what we hope to make it. Here's the model for community colleges, and you'll see from this graphic that the student share is actually less than half of the total cost of attendance, and that's because of our wanting to make sure that that reasonable student work effort was going to provide enough of a contribution to cover what their need was. And because community colleges have a lower amount of tuition, it ends up actually being a slightly less than 50% share. For the four-year institutions, again, this is predicated on the average cost of attending one of the Oregon University System schools. This is what the model will look like with the student carrying about half of the share and Pell coming in along with the tax credits. And this is one of the things that was a bit controversial. The financial aid offices report that, unfortunately, some families don't claim the tax credits to which they're eligible. We didn't feel like it was appropriate for the state to cover that gap, but that perhaps we needed to do more outreach to families to help them understand how to claim the federal tax credits that they're eligible for. Mm-hmm. The tax credits generally are not a resource to our lowest income families, though, because they don't have an income tax obligation. So that's the reason why you see that swap not kicking in until other ways up the income scale. So The Access and Affordability Work Group concluded its work.
Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I don't, in looking at the two models, trying to distinguish that you have between the four-year institution and the two-year institutions. It seems that families share, and both is at about the same income level, that is $60,000. And of course, two-year institutions are, I guess you're figuring they're $2,600, $2,700 cheaper, and that is to make up for the 2 to 12 or 2 to 15, which I guess comes out about even. Is that the way the arithmetic is supposed to be working on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes, the cost of attendance is less at our two-year institutions than our four-year colleges, and because of that, that was where the feeling of the work group was that we should maintain it so that it would be work effort alone that should cover the student's contribution for those schools. But that for 2 years out of a four-year degree, a student should have the option to not have to borrow if they were willing to go to a more economical learning choice for them.
Are the figures that you're using from 176 and 14859, are those your estimated cost for Oregon State public institutions in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, these were the numbers that the work group had available to them last summer. As we go to the slide that I've just moved to, I'm going to talk about how I've updated those figures.
Okay.
But I didn't have the time or resources to update the graphic.
That's fine. I appreciate that. But these are based on Oregon universities?
Yes. Yes. Okay. These are Oregon schools, Oregon averages.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Representative Morning.
I think I love the graphics. I think they really make it easy to see the components of this. I'm wondering, I could see that in some of the students that I know, not many, but some, there would be some thought that this would be an easy way to kind of pay the bills and make a living. And I'm wondering what the expectation is in on the part of the students in terms of achievement, how they're going to do in grade point averages and other units of measurement, and whether there's some kind of time constraints. I mean, can you enter into a 20-year program here? Where are the edges of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, presently the state's policy is that a student is eligible for 4 academic years of Oregon Opportunity Grant assistance. We are proposing to maintain that 4 years. That's 3 terms per year over a 4-year academic period. Some students may take 8 years in which to do that, particularly now under our part-time model where they may just use half of a term each quarter. But over time, once they've used up those 4 years, then they're done in terms of state assistance under our current model.
And is there a requirement around the grades they have to achieve while they're in the program?
Mr. Chair, program? Representative Morgan, in order for a student to continue to be eligible for the Pell Grant and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, they have to show that they're making sufficient academic progress, which means that they have to have earned enough credit hours in order to be moving towards degree in order to maintain their eligibility. And the financial aid offices are connected to the registrar's office with mechanisms in which to monitor that, both for our purposes as well as for federal financial aid purposes.
So I'm not real familiar with all the... Can you kind of give me an example of somebody that would become ineligible because of their academic achievement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if a student failed too many classes or withdrew from too many classes so that they weren't earning enough credit hours each term, then that would be something that would cause them to basically enter into academic probation which would then put in question their financial aid package. So if that's one of those things that the financial aid office monitors in conjunction with the academic advising side.
With the indulgence of the chair, I would be very interested, and this may be an OSAC question, what that actually looks like in terms of how low can you achieve, how many classes can you fail. I mean, I don't get what that actually looks like in reality, and I can appreciate that there is some kind of an edge to this, but and I'm not asking for it right now. Just at some point, if you could get me that information, I would very much appreciate understanding that better.
And if I could just follow up, because I think it's a good question. So it sounds like the way, in terms of the way you were describing it, adequate yearly progress might depend on the institution.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
So each school sets its criteria for graduation or completion of the program, and the student has to meet those expectations in a reasonable fashion, or their whole aid package becomes in jeopardy.
I wanted to ask one question that I should have asked before, and I apologize. Do you know what's the cutoff now for Pell Grant? What's the income level at which it cuts off?
Mr. Chair, it's about $45,000 for a family of four in terms of eligibility. And different family compositions have different numbers, and it all goes into how the expected family contribution is calculated.
That helps. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I don't understand, in relationship to your question, the cutoff, and I assume you're talking about the state share, the state kind of...
No. For the Pell Grant, the federal government sets its own eligibility criteria for different family compositions and income levels.
Yes.
And for a family of four with a dependent student, it's about $45,000. But it's also a declining slope. The more income the family has, the less assistance the student receives.
Okay.
So in order to be prepared for these hearings, I felt you would probably want to know what this is going to look like for the academic year 2008-2009, which is the first year that we want this program to operate. So I took the model that was developed by the Western Interstate Compact on Higher Education, and in consultation with their staff in Colorado, I went through and updated that for numbers as best we knew them. So the Oregon minimum wage has gone up to $7.80 an hour. At the point in which this program will be effective, I would estimate that it will probably rise as much next year as what it did this year, bringing us to hopefully $8.10 an hour. The Pell Grant maximum was the same for 3 years running at $4,050, but in the last few weeks, Congress has acted and it's been raised to $4,310. Now, Congress may take other actions between now and the start date for this program, but given the uncertainty and the few changes it's had, I felt it was inappropriate to change it any further. Tuition and fees for our Oregon University system, your committee plays a very important role in gauging what those changes are going to be. But for community colleges, those decisions are made by the 17 locally elected boards. But in order to give you a ballpark of what these figures should be, I've built in the assumptions that are included in the governor's recommended budget, which is 3.4% per year for both sets of institutions.
May I ask one
Mr. Chair,
question?
I'm sorry.
Okay, my question was around, can you help me understand what the edges are in a definition of a part-time student? Is there some minimum number of hours that a student has to be enrolled in before they're eligible for the grant? Could you be involved in just registered for one class? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the answer to your question is yes, if it's 6 credits or more, and that's what's defined as being half-time or more at your institution.
Okay, so it's a minimum of 6 credit minimum of 6 credit hours for that semester
or quarter, depending
on what your division is in the school.
Yeah,
okay, thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lowe.
Good afternoon.
I have what I think is a simple question. Does the governor's recommended budget include the sufficient tuition support to keep the fee increase in the 08-09 school year to 3.4%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, yes, it does.
Okay.
I try to be consistent as much as what I could discern throughout this.
Okay.
The model needed to be modified and updated because they just released a new one that now counts each part-time student as a separate recipient, and that changed our total head count somewhat from what the earlier numbers were as well. Are there other questions before I move into the examples?
Just an observation, Mr. Chair. I've always had problems with this, but considering 12 hours to be a full-time student, in fact, a student would not be able to graduate in 5 years if they carried 12 hours a year or 12 hours a term for the five-year period of time. They'd still probably be in the neighborhood of about 10 hours short, depending on 6 to 10 hours short, depending on the institution, I think. And 6 hours, of course, would translate out to the same thing as far as half-time is concerned. It's always been a concern to me that these were not really based on what should be a normal progression. This is a pretty slow progression, 12 hours a term, in the typical university setting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, having two dependents for college students, yes, that's something I watch closely as a parent. But also another thing to keep in mind is many of our students who are in college now oftentimes enter already with a lot of college credit hours earned or accepted from their AP classes or community college credits that they earned while in high school. The important piece of that 12-hour or 6-hour expectation is that if a student for some reason needs to withdraw from a class or drop a class, it doesn't put their whole aid package in jeopardy as they drop maybe from 15 hours back to 12 hours. And so I think it's a reasonable model for a few terms, but certainly not as an average. It would certainly slow progression to graduation otherwise.
Representative Morgan?
That then brings to mind, because I recall that most students take 5 years to get what we consider a bachelor's degree. And so if they're only eligible for the shared responsibility support for 4 years, what happens in that fifth year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, in our current situation, the student then needs to turn to either one, more work, or two, more borrowing. And under this model, that would still be the case because we're still projecting a four-year eligibility period. Now, statutorily and policy-wise, you could make some other choices, but that certainly carries with it a price tag.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think the Access Affordability Group discussed that, and they recognize that the reason our students are taking longer than 4 years is not surprisingly related to the affordability problem. And if we can actually make it to the point where we've gotten the students so that they can afford to go on a full-time basis, this then creates an incentive for them to finish sooner than perhaps we've gotten in the habit of doing. So I think that was part of the consideration of the committee at the time.
Representative Morgan.
And I understand that that would have some impact, but I also recall from the discussion that there were other barriers, that there weren't enough classrooms for people, and that the particular classes that people had to take, particularly at higher levels, weren't always available when they needed to be in the cycle. So I think it is something that we need to kind of mark as something to keep our eye on here, because it would be, I think, a real heartbreaker to get these people right to the place where they're ready to step through, and then we pull the rug out from under them.
Madam Chair, I think you'll hear that discussion in two other budgets that will be coming up before you pretty soon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, I would use this as an opportunity to plug our enterprise approach, where are trying to address enrollment growth and student-faculty ratios, we hope would go a long ways towards addressing that particular shortfall as well.
Then I have one more area. With reference to part-time students, and there are, I think those are probably one of the fastest-growing areas of enrollment, are people that are either going back to upgrade their degree or are working and, raising a family, single moms and things like that, that are trying to get skills to get ahead. And I'm wondering what happens with the four-year limitation on the program for those folks, where it's reasonable to expect that it's going to take them much longer than 4 years to get to a goal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, our part-time students are only using half a term's eligibility when they're drawing benefits as a part-time
student.
So it stretches out for them for twice as much
time.
Okay,
thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Representative Morgan's concerns about the eligibility period. I'm wondering if you've taken the time to model what might happen if, for instance, you allow the eligibility period to be 6 years, calendar years, with the eligibility for the shared responsibility model to exist for that four kind of academic years within that period.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I've not done that modeling, but the model would certainly give us the flexibility in which to do so. So I'd be glad to look at that for you.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Chair, follow-up?
Yeah, my primary question is whether or not there are any incremental costs to possibly extending the eligibility period over a course of calendar years, even though you're essentially serving the student within the same academic period. In other words, if the student spends more semesters than might be typical in a four-year period as a part-time student, it may not be perfectly proportional to the amount of administrative costs or whatnot that you would assume that's assumed under the current model. So I'd just be curious to find out if there is any kind of incremental or nominal or marginal additional cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the model is very efficient in terms of how it works in terms of awarding. We still use the FAFSA application process through the Student Assistance Commission. They transmit an electronic file to all of the institutions the student has expressed an interest in on their FAFSA form. The awarding is then actually done by the institutions that the student has said they are considering attending. Mm-hmm. And I think each of those institutions have also very much automated the awarding process. So I think everyone in the system certainly wants to support that student in whatever their educational process is. And I don't think you would see impediments there. I think the place where we want to make sure we don't make it too complex, the model actually allows us to measure different levels of part-timeness from half-time to three-quarter time to full-time. But we've really steered away from differentiating between half-time and three-quarter time because it becomes very difficult then to track how much remaining eligibility a student has. Mm-hmm. And we think it's important for the student to be able to recall that fairly simply as well as the system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, and it's still a continuation of the same, I suppose, questions or themes here. And my concern over the 12 hours full-time load, 6 hours, the half-time load. And I understand, has been said, and I understand some of the rationalization for that, but I would submit for you that you create a false image to students with doing this and calling 12 hours a full-time load. Over the course of 26 years, I've been an academic advisor for, I figured out here, something in the neighborhood of 2,500 students. And I can't tell you the hundreds of times I've had students, in for academic advising, planning their academic career on the basis of full-time student being 12 hours and they're expecting to graduate in 4 years. And the number of calls I've gotten from parents who are ticked off because, whoops, my kid's got to go to school for another full year at whatever. And it was much, much cheaper at the time that I'm dealing with. And I can't imagine how high rate some of them might be today. So I just really seriously, and I know this is going to do no good other than for me to vent my spleen. The use of the term 12 hours is a full-time load.
I don't know. Mr. Chair, just to respond, I think it's really important that we beef up the academic advising that happens for students throughout the system. I think that's the remedy for this. To change how we package aid, I think, creates more risk than it does solution.
Representative Morgan.
Well, and I'm frustrated that we're running out of time here because this is just getting pretty interesting. Again, I have questions
I'm glad to stay.
About the the way that the model is constructed, and it would be interesting if we could have some idea of what the expectations would be for the percentage of students that would be able to complete in 4 years and the percentage of students where it would take longer than that. Because if there's a significant number of students that aren't going to be able to get through the programs in 4 years, then it seems like the program isn't going to live up to its expectations because it isn't going to get them across the finish line. And that if that is the case, and I'm sure that, because I know that the people that worked on this did a fabulous job, and that may have already been part of what they worked on and discussed in the formation of the model, but I would be interested in more background information on what happens with the students that can't complete in 4 years and have to go to 5 years. And is there some kind of an exception for them to be able to continue to get aid? And I recognize, I mean, the balance is that you want to provide the most incentive to students that you can to be as efficient in their use of time as possible. But at the same time, there has to be a realistic assessment of what the system will allow them to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I will be glad to go back and work on using the model to look more prospectively towards extended time to diploma scenarios. I think that's your question. I think there are also some specific majors that we have now in some of our schools where the expectation now will be that it takes those students 5 years to earn a degree rather than four.
Teaching is
education is
example,
one. I think engineering in many of our disciplines is as well. So I think we have some specific academic programs where there might be a reason to do it, and then I think we might have some other broader issues. These might be things that we need to actually study in the next interim. I think we expect that the Access and Affordability Work Group will have reason to need to continue to study, one, what are the effects of our policy changes on student enrollment and participation rates, but beyond that, then what are other things that we can do in order to encourage completion in a more timely way, and what are other mechanisms in order to increase students attending college.
If I might just have a follow-up.
Sure.
But is it possible to get some information around the percentage of students and the length of time it takes them to complete their education? Because I think that information would be significant as we discuss the fiscal impacts of this and the roll-up potential of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'll work with the institution research components in higher education and community colleges and see what we can put together for you.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, looks like, and is it pronounced Lau?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay, Ms. Lau. Unfortunately, we've come to the end today. We're scheduled for Monday to do a public hearing and public testimony, and I think we're going to have to try to find another day. We normally meet Monday through Thursday. Tomorrow we actually, hate to remind you all, but tomorrow we're meeting after the full Ways and Means Committee meets. We're doing the cemetery and mortuary.
The nursing home administrators and counselors and therapists.
Oh.
I thought we were,
okay. That's exciting. Yes. So, sorry to sort of cut you off, but we appreciate it for today. And like I said, I think we're going to have to look at our calendar and try to figure out it where we can find another day.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I think that this is a policy piece in the higher ed and community college arena that is really critical, and that to give it not the time that it deserves, I don't think is fair to it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. So, yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
I'll be glad to return.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing at 5044, and we are adjourned.